It's the afternoon of Thursday, June the 7th, 1520, and we're in northern France. Two great entourages, made up of thousands of men and women, approach each other from opposite sides of a wide field. At the head of one is Henry VIII, the King of England. He's only 28 years old, and he cuts a svelte figure, resplendent in doublet and mantle of silver cloth, boldly accessorized with a belt of real gold. He sits proudly on his magnificent white charger. The horse is splendidly decked out too. Gold bells jangle on its reins and along the fringe of its ornamental covering or caparison. Across from him is Francis I of France, similarly young, handsome, and richly dressed. From a distance, it looks like two armies marching into battle, and indeed, the English lords have so much gold in their clothing that at one point, their French counterparts think they're wearing armour. They pause, refusing to continue onwards, until they feel reassured that the English are not coming to invade. Because this isn't a battle. It's a diplomatic meeting. It's also a party of epic proportions. Thanks to all the clothes and tents made of gold fabric, the event will be known to history as the Field of the Cloth of Gold. After years of rivalry and conflict, England and France are finally coming together in the name of peace. It won't last. Within a couple of years, the two nations will be at war again. But for now, diplomacy is on everyone's minds. At last, the two kings draw level with one another. They doff their caps and dismount, walking the last few paces with arms outstretched to embrace as brothers. The tension eases. It has taken months of diplomacy to get to this moment, and that's before we get to the sheer amount of physical labour that has gone into making this meeting happen. Over the last 2 months, armies of workmen and servants have been busy putting together the extensive facilities needed for this historic summit. It's an incredible feat of planning and logistics. Everywhere you look, you can see the tents and structures built to house, feed, and entertain the 12,000 people who are attending. On the English side, you can see the sprawling camp of conical silk tents, as well as tilt yards for the jousts that will take place over the coming days. A royal pavilion of crimson and gold has been put up so that the English court can enjoy the entertainments in comfort. Workmen have even built a replica palace to accommodate Henry and his Spanish queen, Catherine of Aragon. Measuring 100 metres along each side, it's made of canvas stretched over a timber frame and has been painted to look like masonry. The windows are fitted with so much real stained glass that the French have taken to calling it the Crystal Palace. There's a courtyard in the centre and a chapel at the back. Out front, there's a wine fountain. Yes, that's right, a wine fountain. This is glamping, Tudor style. Of course, all these people have to be fed. Kitchen tents have been erected and bread ovens built to prepare the food that the masses will consume, with hundreds of servants to do the work. Over 18 days of feasting and celebration, the English alone will consume 98,000 eggs, 2,000 sheep, 13 swans, and 3 porpoises. And that's just for starters. To wash it all down, there's around 200,000 litres of wine and 66,000 litres of beer. After the two kings separate from their embrace, the party of the century begins. The royal entourages are seated at long tables in the great pavilion. Silver platters, groaning under the weight of gourmet showstoppers, are brought out in a seemingly endless procession. Elaborate food sculptures depict heraldic and moral themes. Guests marvel at architectural wonders crafted from sugar and marzipan. The feasting goes on long into the night. The next day, like every day to come, is set aside for jousting and other sports. Unlike most dinner party hosts, Henry and Francis don't have to deal with the dreaded clean-up. They can spend the day demonstrating their prowess as sportsmen. I hate to disappoint you, but we're not here to talk about the jousting today. Rather than heading to the tilt yard with the other spectators, let's follow the servants. They're the ones who pour the wine into Henry and Francis's cups and clear the dirty dishes away after their magnificent feasts. They're the thousands of people forgotten by history who have made these days of partying possible. And right now, they have a lot of washing up to do. You might well be wondering why we're talking about the clean-up. Well, over the past millennia, dishwashing has had a massive effect not just on how we live, but on the fabric of society as a whole. Ordinary things and ordinary people matter. And nowhere is this more apparent than in the history of washing up. I'm Ruth Goodman. I've spent my life exploring the extraordinary history of everyday items, the little things that we often take for granted. You see, every object in your home has a fascinating hidden history, a story that's just waiting to be told. Today, we're getting our hands dirty as we uncover the unexpected history of washing up. So, come with me, and together we'll explore the curious history of your home. Let's follow one of the English scullery boys as he heads into the massive makeshift kitchen on the outskirts of the Field of the Cloth of Gold. Hundreds of servants have converged in this dank and smoky place. Some are busy delicately scrubbing gold and silver plates, worth more than they will make in a lifetime. Others scour large metal vessels caked with the residue of the rich sauces and exotic dishes that their noble counterparts have just enjoyed. The plates and cookware all come out looking sparkling clean. But just how are they doing this? Because looking around, one thing you don't see is washing up liquid. In the Tudor era, soap existed, but it was expensive. Far too valuable for something as mundane as washing the dishes. So how did they do the washing up without it? That's a question that has fascinated me for the past 30 years. That's actually the question that got me interested in domestic history in the first place. When I started off as a historical reenactor, long before I published any books or participated in any documentaries, one of my colleagues told me that people in the Tudor period simply didn't do the washing up. According to this person, they just let the dogs lick the bowls and plates clean. But I thought to myself, that can't be true. People would surely have been sick all the time. What about people who didn't have dogs? So I started digging. And it turns out that to answer the question of how the Tudors did the dishes, we have to go back hundreds, if not thousands of years, and look at how societies throughout history have tackled the washing up. Now, it can be hard to work out how this chore was done in the past. For example, there's an amazing ceramic figurine from 6th century China that shows a man washing dishes at a dedicated washing up bench. Unfortunately, the model isn't detailed enough to show what washing aids he might have used. But all over the world, our ancestors seem to have figured out two main ways of doing the dishes. The first method involved using some kind of naturally occurring substance, often sand, to scour or mechanically remove dirt before rinsing them off in water. The Romans scrubbed their dishes with sand, or crushed up cuttlefish bones, or sometimes a plant known as horsetail. Its rough, jointed stems made it perfect for scouring wooden and metal vessels. In medieval European castles, a different plant with a confusingly similar name, mare's tail, was used to scrub the dishes. Mare's tail grows like a weed and can be found on the sides of damp ditches across the UK. Within the tissues of this plant are microscopic platelets of silica. It's a natural Brillo pad, biodegradable and sustainable. But medieval servants knew not to roughly scrub everything. Delicate items were washed separately in a tub, padded with a soft cloth to prevent chips and cracks. Sometimes people in the Middle Ages avoided the majority of the problem of washing up altogether. They would serve dinner in big dishes made of stale bread, known as trenchers. And at the end of the meal, they simply ate the plates, or gave them to the poor, for them to eat. The second historical method of washing up was chemical. Servants in medieval Europe used all sorts of fruit and vegetable acids, such as sorrel, or if they could afford it, rhubarb juice, to clean and polish brass vessels. Centuries earlier, in ancient China, they had discovered a chemical that could cut through grease, in effect a detergent. A Chinese text from the 2nd century BC describes using wood or plant ash to wash the grease out of clothing. It's possible they used a similar mixture to deal with greasy pots and pans too. All of this takes us back to Tudor England. After going through thousands of household inventories and shopping lists from the period, I learned that the Tudors continued to use a combination of mechanical scouring and chemicals to help them deal with the washing up. To get out tough, stuck-on stains, Tudors used either sand or mare's tail. And the chemical cleaner was the same as in ancient China, wood ash. Now, this was the wonder chemical of the past. It was used for cleaning right across the globe for centuries. Because you see, all wood ash, no matter what wood you've burned, contains potassium hydroxide. This is an alkali that can cut through grease, kill bacteria, and even bleach a little too. Cleaning a greasy pot with wood ash is simple. Take a handful of ash, drop it in a pan, put the pan over the fire and throw in a bit of water. Quickly scrub round and rinse. This method can even lift the rust off metal cooking vessels. Alternatively, you can strain the wood ash through a cloth to extract the potassium hydroxide, creating a liquid filled with concentrated lye. Simply dip a dish in this liquid and follow up by rinsing it in clean water. So, if we had this system that was super effective, that actually worked to clean our dishes, why on earth did it change? The main reason is coal. You see, for centuries all around the world, we had been primarily burning wood in our homes. This provided us with wood ash, a free cleaning chemical. Not a problem. But then we made the switch to coal. And a coal fire is useless on the cleaning front. This happened first in London, in the reign of Henry VIII's daughter, Elizabeth I. A change that had huge impacts, including a upon the washing up. Now that they were burning coal in their houses, people were forced to find other ways than sand and wood ash to clean their pots and pans. People looked around themselves. What did they find? Soap, kick-starting a vast expansion in the soap industry, beginning in England, but soon spreading around the world. By the late 1700s, industrially manufactured bars of soap became available in Europe and America, and missionaries in the colonies began promoting its use. At the same time, advertising campaigns began to encourage people to keep themselves and their homes clean to avoid disease. But soap wasn't without its problems. You see, wood ash worked brilliantly even in cold water. Soap, however, needs hot water in order to activate. And getting hot water in those days was not as easy as turning on a tap. You had to fill a heavy pan with water, lug it over to the stove and boil it up. What a faff. The soap boom also had a far from positive effect on global ecosystems. Soap had become big business, but the domestic supply of animal fat needed to make it couldn't keep up with the demand. So the soap industry turned to whaling. The demand for soap was one of the main factors that led to the rapid growth of the whaling industry. Catches went from just 2,000 a year to 20,000 a year by the end of the 19th century, pushing many species to the verge of extinction. It just goes to show how changes in domestic life can affect the world as a whole. Even with the advent of soap, washing up was still a laborious task. Just like in the medieval castle, nearly every type of dish or utensil in the Victorian kitchen had to be washed differently. And cooking was only getting more elaborate as time went on. Copper pudding moulds had a very different cleaning process to bone-handled knives. Fine items like china and silver were a real to-do, and it was so easy to crack porcelain and crystal. It's no wonder, then, that towards the end of the Victorian period, people got fed up. And one woman in particular took her frustrations and channeled them into a world-changing invention. It's the year 1893, and we're at the World Columbian Exposition in Chicago. This place is truly a wonder. The organisers have essentially built a mini city within Chicago's confines to exhibit all the wonders of the modern world. Massive neoclassical buildings surround us, all centred around a glittering man-made pool. We're told that this place is an example of the city of the future. And looking around, it's easy to believe. For starters, it's all run on electricity. A complete novelty for most Americans. Everywhere you glance, there's something new to see. To your right, there's the massive Ferris wheel, the first ever to be built. To your left, the Travelator, a moving walkway which will take us all the way down to the casino without us having to take a single step. We could go take a ride on a newfangled electric automobile. Maybe later, we'll go and see Harry Houdini perform magic, sample a bizarre new spread called peanut butter, or even check out Thomas Edison's brand new kinetoscope, which shows actual moving pictures. But first, we're headed to the Machinery Hall to see the exhibit that everyone's talking about. It's a machine that can wash an incredible 240 dishes in just 2 minutes. I mean, imagine. And get this, its inventor is the only woman presenting. Her name is Josephine Cochrane, and the story of how she got here is almost as amazing as her new machine. Josephine Josephine was a wealthy woman who loved throwing lavish dinner parties. Now, as was customary, she only used her best china for these gatherings, a collection of heirloom pieces which dated back to the 17th century. But Josephine soon grew frustrated by the way the staff kept chipping her priceless dishes during the washing up process. So she decided to wash the china herself. There was just one problem. She soon found that, well, washing the dishes is tedious. She also discovered that chipping dishes is pretty inevitable when you're washing them by hand, no matter how careful you are. There's got to be a better way, she thought to herself. And that's when she got the idea for a machine that could do the washing up for her. You see, Josephine wasn't a typical wealthy housewife. Invention ran in her blood. Her grandfather was the inventor of the first patented steamboat, and her father was a civil engineer. They had taught her that most problems in the modern world have a mechanical solution. So Josephine decided, if nobody else is going to invent the washing machine, do it myself. Drawing on her inventor roots, she quickly started working on her design. And then, in 1883, disaster struck. Her husband died after a long battle with alcoholism. Sadly, he didn't leave Josephine a wealthy widow. No, he left her with a huge pile of debt and just $1,500 to her name. Her idea for a dishwashing machine suddenly became a financial necessity. But getting a working prototype proved difficult. You see, Josephine's idea was unique. Rather than using mechanized scrubbing brushes like previous designs for dishwashers, hers used water pressure. It was, as we know today, a revolutionary idea. But Josephine wasn't an engineer, so couldn't build the machine herself. Luckily, she found a young mechanic named George Butters, who immediately recognized the brilliance of her idea. He agreed to build the machine exactly as she had designed it. Together, they constructed a working prototype in Josephine's woodshed. On December the 28th, 1886, Josephine was granted the patent for her dishwashing machine. But her troubles didn't end there. Potential investors were only interested if she resigned and turned management of the company over to men. Josephine refused. She would go on without their help. This proved to be the right choice, and those would-be investors must have been kicking themselves when her dishwasher became one of the smash hits of the World's Columbian Exposition. 9 of her machines were installed in various restaurants and pavilions around the venue, and her invention even won first prize for best machine at the exhibition. Soon, her dishwasher could be found in restaurants, colleges, hotels and hospitals around the world. It was a true modern marvel, saving workers time and companies money. But there were a few problems with Josephine's dishwasher. Firstly, it was too big, especially for a small domestic space. It also used an awful lot of hot water at a time when getting that into every home wasn't easy. And it was expensive too. Great in a hotel, not so good in your own kitchen. And so the history of the dishwasher lingers for a while until a new and rather surprising inventor turns up on the scene. The English weapons engineer, William Howard Livens. Today, Livens is best known for the weapons he invented during World War I. The Great War, you see, was the first to use mechanized warfare on a grand scale. Each side tried to outdo the other with ever more deadly weapons. Tanks, mortars, and machine guns were all new and terrifyingly efficient killing machines that brought about destruction on a scale never seen before in human history. 2 of the more controversial weapons were poison gas and flamethrowers. It was in these areas that Livens specialised. His most famous invention is what's known as the Livens projector, a fairly simple mortar-like weapon that could throw or project large drums filled with flammable, or toxic chemicals towards the enemy. It was devastatingly efficient and could cover huge swathes of land with pools of burning oil or gas, miles of German trenches. Livens would go on to create even more weapons in World War II. But between the wars, he was left twiddling his thumbs. So he turned his attention to creating a dishwasher that could fit in your home. It had all the familiar modern features of a dishwasher: a front-loading door, wire racks for crockery, and a rotating spraying mechanism. He hoped that it would help maids and housewives to more efficiently run a clean home. But despite Livens's improvements, domestic dishwashers took a while to catch on. This was partly because they were still expensive, and partly because not everybody had the electricity to run them. That all changed after the Second World War, when electricity became far more widespread. Dishwashers started to become widely accessible. During this era, we see a marketing push aimed directly at mid-century housewives. These ads promised that machines like the dishwasher and washing machine would liberate women from the shackles of domestic toil, freeing them up to spend more time with their families or doing things they enjoyed. And as it turns out, these advertisements were sort of right. In 1900, before the advent of appliances and widespread electricity, the average household spent a whopping 58 hours a week on housework. By 1975, that number had dropped to just 18. In fact, the number of hours spent on housework decreased steadily as home appliances became more affordable. Now, in these eras, it was predominantly women who did most of the housework. Suddenly, housewives had an extra 40 hours a week on their hands. And what did women do with all this newfound free time? Well, it appears they went to work. According to multiple sociological and economic studies, there is a direct correlation between the decline in the number of hours spent on domestic housework and the number of women entering the workforce. By 1975, the number of married women in the workforce had rocketed to around 45%. Today, that number sits well above 60%. Now, of course, the dishwasher and other home appliances aren't the only reason behind more women entering the workforce. The impact of the wars and the women's rights movement can't be ignored. But it just goes to show how something as seemingly mundane as washing the dishes or doing the laundry can influence monumental social changes. A lot has changed about all aspects of society since the times when we used scouring sand and wood ash to do the washing up. And as we've seen, some of those changes happened as a direct result of new dishwashing techniques. So next time it's your turn to do the washing up or load the dishwasher, why not stop for a second? Think about the long and curious history behind even this everyday household chore. It's one of the many little things in life whose significance we take for granted. But I hope I've convinced you by now that it's the little things that really matter. In the next episode, we dig into the surprising history of forks. In medieval Italy, a woman's death is blamed on the two-pronged utensil she uses at her wedding banquet. British taxes lead Americans to invent a unique way of using cutlery. And industrial espionage helps to bring forks to the masses. That's next time on The Curious History of Your Home.